This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. President Bush will speak tonight to the Republican National Convention by satellite. His scheduled appearance last night was canceled, along with most of yesterday's convention plans, because of Hurricane Gustav. My guest Peter Baker writes about the rocky relationship between the president and John McCain in this week's New York Times Magazine. Baker is a national correspondent for the Times and is working on a book about the Bush presidency. He's at the Republican convention in the Twin Cities. Peter Baker, welcome back to Fresh Air. What do you know about what's been going on behind the scenes of the McCain campaign in terms of figuring out what their strategy will be now during the convention in the wake of the hurricane and of the revelations about Sarah Palin?
Well, this has been a week of complete improvisation by the McCain campaign for obvious reasons. They've basically thrown out the script, both on the vice presidential choice and on the hurricane. You know, most McCain staffers didn't expect it to be Sarah Palin either, so this caught a lot of people by surprise. As recently just a couple nights ago, they were calling around a Republican operative saying, hey, can you scramble and get out to Alaska for us? They've got a team up there on the ground right now that will help do their own research into her background beyond the initial vetting that they've done, and to help answer questions by reporters and prepare for the politics of a vice presidential campaign. And then the hurricane, you know, obviously that's something nobody could have expected to come at this exact moment. The irony of 3 years just after Katrina is lost on no one. Fortunately, it turned out not to be, you know, the sort of catastrophe that they had in 2005. And now they're trying to get back going with the convention with a sort of abbreviated format. But I think you'll start to see a lot more of the conventional convention starting tonight.
Is the McCain campaign convinced that it did an adequate job vetting Sarah Palin?
They say that she was fully vetted, that she was looked at just as thoroughly as any of the other finalists that they considered. But there's certainly some reason to look at that and wonder exactly. I mean, she clearly came up late in the process as the final choice the senator made, and you know, a team didn't arrive in Alaska until Thursday, last Thursday, the same day that she was being offered the job. So, you know, unlike some of the other candidates he was considering who were well-known on the national stage and have been vetted, in effect, by the national media before, so any issues were already more or less on the table, Sarah Palin's something of an unknown, and so we're now beginning to pour through her life and seeing all the impressive things and the other things that are issues that she and her family have to deal with.
President Bush was supposed to speak last night at the Republican convention, but because of Hurricane Gustav, the McCain campaign and the convention, they threw out all of their plans. So it was unclear whether President Bush would end up speaking at the convention or not. Now we know he's going to speak tonight by video to the convention. You've just written an article for the New York Times Magazine about the rocky relationship between John McCain and President Bush. What do you know about what happened behind the scenes in terms of deciding whether or not to use tonight as a second chance for President Bush to speak to the convention?
Well, I mean, look, there's no question that if you were to get some of Senator McCain's closest advisors, you know, to take a polygraph test, they would really open up. They would probably acknowledge that they were never all that thrilled about having President Bush address the convention. And that, you know, the hurricane coming along gave them sort of a convenient way of sort of avoiding that, at least an in-person address. At the same time, they want to be careful because while President Bush is unpopular with the broad public, he still has a lot of support among solid conservatives, Republicans, and those are the people who are here at this convention. So any appearance of disrespecting him would be a problem for Senator McCain, given that the hurricane didn't turn out to be as devastating as some had feared. People would wonder, I think, why he didn't then, you know, get a chance to address the convention at least by video over the next few days. And so they really had no choice but to arrange something like this. And for his part, I don't think President Bush was all that looking forward to coming here and, you know, celebrating John McCain's takeover of the party, in effect. I mean, Senator McCain has run a, you know, pretty tough campaign with regard to President Bush. Up just a few weeks ago, he ran an ad that said, we're worse off than we were 4 years ago. That's the kind of ad the opposition runs usually, not the standard bearer of your own party. So there's no great enthusiasm between these two men, but they also have their fates tied together by history. It's in both of their interests that Senator McCain win this election, and they're both doing what they can to do that.
The Obama campaign has been describing the McCain campaign as four more years of Bush-Cheney. And you say about McCain, quote, he finds himself saddled with the baggage of a man he never much liked to begin with, forced to live with a record he personally considers deeply lacking, and portrayed as if he were a clone of his longtime adversary, unquote. What were some of the things that the Bush campaign did against the McCain campaign in 2000 when McCain was running in the primary for the Republican nomination? Things that the Bush campaign did that were most infuriating to McCain?
Well, the crucible came in South Carolina, which is the most important primary that followed Senator McCain's upset victory in New Hampshire. And that was just a two-week period of brutal, very low-ball politics in which flyers and telephone calls around the state spread all sorts of insidious and mostly false stories about Senator McCain, you know, that he was some sort of Manchurian candidate, that he had fathered a black child out of wedlock, that that his wife was a drug addict, all sorts of stuff that was just very, very, you know, scurrilous in most cases. And while they never had any evidence that the Bush campaign per se was involved in any of this, certainly to the McCain camp, they knew who benefited by it, and that was something that colored the relationship forever. Senator McCain wrote in one of his memoirs, you know, about the night of the New Hampshire primary when he and Governor Bush called. It was a concession call. He says, "We hung up the phone that night as friends. We would be friends no longer." Today both men and their people would tell you, "Well, we got over that a long time ago." But there's still, it's hard to get over that sort of thing, and it still, I think, frames the dealings between these two men, and certainly, for instance, Cindy McCain continues, I think, according to people around them, to remain very bitter about the way her family was dragged through the mud.
John McCain deplored the kind of negative tactics that Karl Rove was behind in politics, yet now McCain has two people who worked on Rove's team, Steve Schmidt and Nicole Wallace, in key positions within McCain's campaign. Do you know why he hired people who practiced the kind of tactics that McCain has said he deplored?
Well, I'm not sure I would buy that, actually. You know, the idea that Steve Schmidt and Nicole Wallace are Karl Rove clones, I think, is sort of not very true. I mean, did they work in the Bush White House? Yes, they did. And did they work in Bush campaigns? Yes, they did. And so in that sense, obviously, they have seen Karl Rove's strategies up close and been part of them in that sense, but they're not his proteges. That's been sort of exaggerated, I think. Both of them, in fact, spent their time in the White House at various moments fighting with Karl Rove over various things. They're not going to advertise that today, but they're not Karl Rove clones. You know, I think the senator's campaign this last few weeks and months has obviously gotten sharper in its attacks on Senator Obama. It's certainly taken a more negative tack. That's not entirely surprising for an underdog campaign. But, you know, I'm not sure how far it's gone over any lines at this point. I mean, you know, pointing out that Senator Obama seems to be a celebrity is hardly the same thing as some of the stuff that Senator McCain was subjected to in South Carolina. But we'll see. It's still early. We're just at Labor Day. We're just the beginning of the fall campaign. We've just finished the preseason, and we're only now beginning into the regular season. So we'll see how far this goes. There's a lot of questions as to whether Senator McCain compromises those kind of values that he talks about in terms of campaigns for the chance to win. This is going to be a real test for him.
One of the places where John McCain has supported President Bush most strongly is the war in Iraq. You got access to a private 3-page letter in which John McCain warned Bush that he would lose the war without an increase in forces. Can you tell us when the letter was sent and what it said?
Right. This is December of 2006. The Republicans had just lost the Congress in midterm elections, and Donald Rumsfeld had just been fired or pushed out as defense secretary. And this is a moment when President Bush was rethinking his strategy, and Senator McCain decided that he had to weigh in if he had any chance of influencing policy. It was the first time Senator McCain had advocated more troops in Iraq, but he saw the body politic in Washington going the other direction, you know, the Baker-Hamilton report and a lot of the new Democrats taking over Congress, and even a lot of Republicans were saying, it's time to withdraw, it's time to begin pulling out, we need to look at scaling back our presence there. And McCain says, no, it's the exact opposite approach. The whole idea of a political reconciliation without fostering security first is lunatic, and you have to do it the other way around. You have to create an environment in which people can safely talk about their differences and create a peaceful resolution to them, and the only way to do that is with more troops on the ground. It was a risky move. It was a risky move for both him and President Bush, and I think that's obviously one risk that today looks better than it did at the time.
How influential would you say McCain was in convincing President Bush to go forward with the surge?
I think he was influential. I don't know whether it was a deciding factor, but, you know, this is a moment when President Bush looked around him and found everybody telling him not to do it, you know, including his own Joint Chiefs of Staff, his field commanders, his Secretary of State, again, the Baker-Hamilton Commission, which represented in some ways the voices of his father's administration. He was a very lonely figure when he decided to authorize the additional 30,000 troops for Iraq. And I think to have Senator McCain there backing him up, I think probably did embolden him. At least it made him think, well, at least I've got, you know, the support of this fellow who's been pretty tough on me over these years, and he's going to stick with me on this policy, and he's going to be running for president, so he's also got something at stake here. And I think it brought them together in a way. I think they both emerge from that moment with more respect for each other. I think they both sat there and said, you know, here is leadership under pressure, and they looked at each other and said, this is somebody we can do business with in the end.
What are your impressions of how confident the McCain campaign is that they will win the election?
I don't think they're overconfident on this right now. I mean, it's an interesting situation where the national polls have been pretty even, and in some ways they're doing much better than a lot of people had expected. Senator McCain's running far ahead of the generic Republican number, which shows that he has an identity with the public that goes beyond conventional party lines. But on the other hand, I don't think they would have picked Governor Palin either if they felt very confident that they were going to win. That's the choice of an underdog. That's the choice of somebody who's taking a risk in order to shake things up. And you know, if you look at some of these state-by-state polls, if you look at intensity of support, things like that, those are troubling signs for Senator McCain. And then just history is a troubling indicator for him. I mean, you don't have too many examples where the incumbent party keeps the White House for a third term, particularly in a time of war and economic disruption and a 75% wrong track number, meaning 75% of the public thinks the country is on the wrong track, and a president whose own approval number is in the high 20s. So, you know, history would suggest that the odds are stacked against Senator McCain.
Peter Baker, thank you so much for talking with us.
Oh, thank you for having me. It's always great to be here.
Peter Baker's article about the relationship between President Bush and John McCain is in this week's New York Times Magazine. He spoke to us from the Twin Cities. Both John McCain and Barack Obama have consulted with General David Petraeus about Iraq, but each candidate has reached a different conclusion about what America's strategy should be. My guest Steve Call writes about Petraeus, the candidates, and the road out of Iraq in the current edition of The New Yorker. Petraeus will leave his position commanding the Iraqi theater on September 15th to assume command of CENTCOM, broadening his responsibilities to the Middle East, Africa, and Central Asia, including the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. Steve Call is a staff writer at The New Yorker and a former foreign correspondent and senior editor at The Washington Post. He's written books about the bin Laden family and the war in Afghanistan. He's also the president of the public policy institute, the New America Foundation. Steve Call, welcome to Fresh Air. Let's start with how General Petraeus thinks we should end the war. What have you learned about that?
Well, he has a war plan that contemplates changes in the role and the mission of U.S. troops in Iraq, and those changes imply, but in the war plan don't make explicit, reductions in the number of troops that would be required. And this war plan is called the Joint Campaign Plan. It's being rewritten right now, actually. The last version was signed off on in November of 2007. And it's a classified document totaling several hundred pages, but it goes out a couple or 3 years in its estimate of where the U.S. is trying to go. And I think the most important element of it, certainly for voters and for American decision-making about Iraq, is this transformation of the U.S. mission from combat and partnering in combat with Iraqi forces to what the plan calls overwatch, which is a more removed posture of support, providing air, intelligence, and logistic support to Iraqi forces. But the plan is interesting in that it doesn't have a fixed timetable, and it certainly does not make specific commitments as to how many troops would be drawn down when. And that, for instance, makes it quite a different formula in those respects from the proposals to end the war that Senator Obama has made.
But, you know, there's an agreement that's been reached between the United States and Iraq that hasn't been signed by the Iraqi government yet. But that calls for basically a timetable. It's a draft agreement that contains a target date of 2011 for the withdrawal of all American combat troops. That's about 18 months later than Obama's plan, but still, it's a timetable. So how does Petraeus's plan square with the fact that the Bush administration and the Iraqi government have reached this tentative agreement that has a timetable?
Well, it's a good question. I think it's, in fact, there was a when Senator Obama and Senator Reid and Senator Hagel visited Iraq in July in the private briefing session they had with General Petraeus, the question you asked was posed, in fact, by Jack Reed, a Democrat from Rhode Island, who's a West Point graduate and a specialist in defense. And he essentially said to Petraeus, look, deadlines are coming. They're coming from the Iraqis. We're going to live with them one way or another. So we need to change our own conversation and come to terms with this idea of timetables. Now, how binding the timetables in this status of forces agreement that you refer to will actually turn out to be, I think, is difficult to assess at this point. This negotiation has dragged on, I think, a lot longer than the Bush administration wanted it to. And even now, this draft agreement seems quite tentative to me. But the essential observation remains the Iraqi government, for domestic political reasons, is insisting upon, and it's difficult to imagine how they could back away from, timetables.
What are the domestic political reasons that you refer to?
Rising Iraqi nationalism, a broad sense, as the violence has calmed in Iraq, it has had political effects in Iraq just as it has had political effects in the United States. And in Iraq, some of those effects have expressed themselves in a sort of more peaceful version of the perceptions and ambitions that fueled the insurgency. That is, Iraqis want their country back, and they want their own institutions to be in the fore of the next phase of national life, including the next phase of counterinsurgency against violent rejectionist groups. So the government of Iraq, led by Prime Minister Maliki, which is a relatively young and not deeply rooted administration, is approaching another round of elections, and politicians are competing to convince voters that they are true Iraqi nationalists and they are not going to tolerate a continuation of American control over Iraqi national life. So that's the political equation that Maliki and others are trying to address with their insistence on timetables.
So both John McCain and Barack Obama have consulted with General David Petraeus. What's the difference between how Obama and McCain have reacted to Petraeus's advice?
Well, they've come at it from very different directions, although these days I think the difference between McCain and Obama's forward-looking plan for Iraq is a lot less stark than it was a couple of years ago. In McCain's case, he was an early and adamant supporter of what came to be known as the surge, the decision by President Bush in announced on January 10, 2007, to dispatch what became about 30,000 additional troops to Baghdad in order to intervene in what was then a multifaceted and deepening civil war in Iraq. And because McCain believed that that was the right response to the conditions at that time, and because he knew Petraeus as an advocate of counterinsurgency tactics that were going to make the surge work or define the surge, he had a kind of natural alliance with the general. On the other hand, Senator Obama was a critic of the surge and a critic of the war. He had voted against it. He had been consistent in his opposition to the basic strategic premises of the war. And so when the surge came along, he saw it in that context, argued against it in that context. And in the political competition that evolved over the Iraq War, both within the Democratic primary and then looking ahead prospectively to the general election cycle in which we now find ourselves, Senator Obama was adamant about his judgment that the war was a mistake and that reinvesting in the war in the form of the surge was also a mistake. And so that created distance in his relationship with Petraeus, General Petraeus. And it was only in 2008 that Senator Obama began to reach out to him privately at first, then talk publicly about the general. And then in July, he went over and met with him in the context of the election campaign.
What do you know about the meeting in Iraq between Obama and Petraeus in July?
I thought it was a really interesting story. Petraeus described it to some extent. I also interviewed Jack Reed, who was in the meeting, and others who were in the meeting who didn't want to be identified. It begins with these really red-hot hearings in September of 2007 when partisan feeling about the war was at its most sort of inflamed. And this was the time when the activist group Move On published an advertisement with the headline General Petraeus or General Betrayus, questioning his reliability as a source of information about the war. And when Democrats and Republicans at these hearings argued vociferously about the surge and about the future direction of the war. And at that hearing, Senator Obama asked, which going back and looking at the transcript, a really important question, and it was a very sort of well-composed question, I thought, just as a sort of lawyerly formulation. And it went to the basic outcome of the war. What is the minimally acceptable end state for American interests that would allow us to start leaving? He asked the general, because the general was saying, we cannot draw down precipitously, so the senator said. Well, then, what are the conditions that will allow us to do that? And in the context of only having 7 minutes to answer questions and clock running and a lot of political sort of argument going on, Petraeus never had a chance to answer the question. So what he told me was that in the subsequent months, it had gnawed at him that he had never been able to have a conversation with Obama about this fundamental question, how does this end? So when Senator Obama arrived in Iraq in July, General Petraeus was waiting for him in a sense, and he, in the briefing, presented a series of charts on storyboard sort of easels and walked through them. And what he tried to describe, he said, was the way his war plan addresses the question that Senator Obama asked. And he talked about this planned transition from combat and partnering with Iraqi forces to a more removed posture of overwatch that would permit the reduction of U.S. troops. And he tried to essentially argue to Senator Obama that he had an end state in mind. He was moving toward that end state, but he was essentially arguing that he needed flexibility as to the pace at which he made that transition.
Well, you say that, you know, General Petraeus is arguing that he needs flexibility. Obama has argued that he needs flexibility, too. He's said he didn't want to get boxed into what he considered two false choices, a rigid timeline, or pledging to do whatever Petraeus tells him is best. Do you know how Petraeus reacted to that?
Well, it's interesting because they essentially went back and forth along the lines that you describe. And Senator Reid told me that Obama also said in the briefing to General Petraeus, look, we have different roles here, and I have to think about flexibility in Iraq in the context of America's global national security and economic interests. And one of the obvious problems that we have to confront is the fact that the war in Afghanistan is relatively under-resourced and we need to be rebalancing forces from Iraq to Afghanistan. And so General Petraeus, I think, recognizes that Senator Obama's timeline is now a political declaration that the senator cannot easily back down from in the context of a campaign against Senator McCain, that this is something that's going to have to wait until after November if Senator Obama is the next president. And I think really in private, both in the Obama camp and in Petraeus's command among his aides, there's an understanding that the difference between what Senator Obama has announced, including this caveat that you mentioned, that he isn't saying he's going to follow his 16-month timetable no matter what. He's saying something more nuanced than that on the one hand, and Petraeus's idea of a flexible transition to Overwatch on the other hand, that the gap between those two plans is not necessarily enormous at all. What's required is for the two of them, if they are going to be working together as president and commander, to have an opportunity to sit down and talk about specifics outside of the context of an election campaign.
Is John McCain on the same page as General Petraeus in terms of a conditions-based withdrawal of combat troops and this kind of drawing down that would lead to a different relationship between American troops and Iraq?
He says that he is. I think his position is essentially, I believe that General Petraeus has it right and I'm going to follow his advice, and that a conditions-based approach is the right one. The change in McCain's rhetoric, anyway, has been to move over the last year away from a position of we'll stay as long as it takes, whatever it takes, this sort of stalwart kind of language that occasionally implied such a long commitment that it was seemed to be out of step with American public opinion to a significant extent. He's backed away from that, and he's now essentially saying, I too will responsibly manage an end to heavy American commitments, but I'm going to do it with General Petraeus's conditions-based formula and not on a fixed timetable.
John McCain, while addressing veterans of foreign wars in Orlando in August, told them that both he and Obama plan to bring U.S. forces home from the war in Iraq, but he said, quote, the great difference is that I intend to win it first. And I'm wondering if General Petraeus ever uses the word win in the context of the war in Iraq.
Never, and he's quite self-conscious about that. And he is, by the accounts of not only himself, but all of the two stars and one stars and colonels and majors that I had a chance to talk to when I was over there, his message is nobody ought to be declaring victory anytime soon, and that even more than that, we ought not to be saying there's light at the end of the tunnel. We ought not to be saying things are going, that we're optimistic. His experience of such language is that it doesn't serve anybody's purpose, and so he has adopted a kind of formulation of neutrality, of sort of empirical language. His standard phrase is that he's no longer an optimist nor a pessimist about Iraq, but a realist. And I asked him at one point whether he thought now, given the reductions in violence, though Iraq is far, far from a normal country, even with these reduced levels of violence, whether he thought it was realistic to be optimistic now. And he said, well, it might be, but you're never going to hear me say that.
How confident is General Petraeus that the gains we've made in reducing violence in Iraq will actually hold?
He says that he's not especially confident, that he believes that these that conditions are still fragile. And just to go back to what we were talking about before, this rising sense of Iraqi nationalism, which you can see expressed in the recent negotiations, for instance, the Maliki government has acquired an enormous amount of confidence in itself over the last 6 months. But whether that confidence is matched by its capacity to actually run the country and reconcile some of these divisions, I think is questionable. The government is feeling its strength, but it hasn't yet demonstrated a sustained capacity to deliver services to its people or to defend the country against internal and external enemies.
John McCain credits the surge in American troops for the decline in violence in Iraq. How much weight does General Petraeus put on the surge in explaining the reduction in violence?
I think it depends on what you mean by the surge, and I found it interesting to discover that there's a discourse inside the military about what the surge means, how it should be interpreted. I think when military officers use the term the surge, they are referring to much more than just the dispatch of additional troops to Iraq. They're also talking about the application of counterinsurgency techniques by General Petraeus and his commanding officers, an emphasis on keeping civilians safe, an emphasis on local governance, on building institutional and governmental services at the local level. And they're also talking about political work by General Petraeus and also Ambassador Ryan Crocker. So when McCain talks about the surge in a political campaign, he may just be using it as a shorthand label. But in the professional military, it's a lot more complicated than just numbers of troops. It's about tactics and counterinsurgency doctrine as well. And in that respect, General Petraeus believes absolutely that the surge, writ large in the way I've just described, is responsible for these reductions in violence.
And when McCain says Obama opposed the surge, what is he accusing Obama of having opposed, and what, in fact, did Obama oppose?
On January 10th, 2007, President Bush announced, after a series of internal reviews, that he was sending more American troops to Iraq to try to quell the violence. Senator Obama was among those who said he thought that the surge was not going to work and that it was only an extension of President Bush's failed approach to the war. Senator McCain was among the relatively small group of American politicians who thought that the surge was just what was needed to bring this violence down. And it turned out that the surge did bring the violence down. It's really not much more complicated than that. But the debate that's continued between Senator McCain and Senator Obama has been about much more than just the surge. To some extent now, it's about judgment. And there, Obama has been able to change the discussion to the broader question of whether the war was wise, whether it was wisely managed, and what McCain has said about those questions over the years as well.
Is that a question that Petraeus is willing to take on, whether the war was wise and wisely managed?
Yes. Interestingly, when I was preparing to go over there and to interview him at length, I looked at written questions and answers that had been created for his recent confirmation as the head of CENTCOM, which is the military command for all U.S. forces in the Middle East. And somebody asked him in writing that question, please tell us the mistakes that have been made in the Iraq War. His answer was 2 pages single-spaced, and it was really quite a list. Started with the basic things that we know, the decision to dissolve the Ba'ath Party without a plan to reintegrate the Sunnis who would be disenfranchised into government and national life, the decision to dissolve the army, the light troop footprint he mentions. He goes through a whole series of sort of errors in the war. And, you know, this is part of army culture. That's pretty admirable as an aspect of the way our government generally runs. The army has a lessons learned center. It's just published the second volume of its own internal history of the Iraq War, and it's a pretty tough document. It's called On Point. You could find it online. It only covers the period up through 2006, but it, like Petraeus's answer, is pretty tough on the decision makers.
What about the question of whether we should have gone to war in Iraq in the first place? Will Petraeus answer that one?
He won't, but I think it's a really intriguing question, because if you read this list of mistakes and some of the other answers that he's given, it wouldn't shock me if, in retirement, he says, of course, I thought the war was a strategic mistake. But as the commander of it now, he's not in any position to talk about something like that.
If you're just joining us, my guest is journalist Steve Call, and we're discussing the article that he wrote in the current edition of The New Yorker. It's called The General's Dilemma, David Petraeus, The Politicians, and the Road Out of Iraq. David Petraeus is about to take over CENTCOM and leave his position as the commander of the troops in Iraq. What will his responsibilities as the head of CENTCOM be?
Well, Well, CENTCOM is the command, the integrated command for all the military services that's organized on geographical lines, and it essentially covers the territory from Egypt in the west to all the way to Central Asia and Pakistan in the east. And the command now is overwhelmed by two wars, one in Iraq and the other in Afghanistan, and Petraeus will in effect oversee both of those wars from the CENTCOM headquarters in Tampa, Florida, and its forward headquarters in Qatar in the Persian Gulf.
I wonder if, and I don't think you'll be able to answer this, but I thought I'd ask it anyways. I wonder if you think his view on the war in Iraq and our strategy there will change when his responsibilities include, you know, cover a much larger region and Iraq is just a part of it.
Now, for the first time, in thinking about troop levels in Iraq, he will have to weigh the costs of heavy investments in Iraq against the need for reinforcements in Afghanistan. In his previous advocacy for more troops to Iraq, it was his role as the theater commander, in effect, to say, I need what I need, and he kept saying, I need a lot. Now he's in the more the judicial chair, hearing theater commanders in two wars argue about what they need and then trying to sort out where the best balance lies. I think a second aspect of this next assignment, of course, is that he's going to try to apply the counterinsurgency principles that he applied in Iraq now to Afghanistan and to Pakistan as well. I talked to him some about that when I was over there. He certainly understands that Pakistan and Afghanistan are very different places from Iraq and that there is no sort of cookbook that you can carry from one country to the other. But he and his cohort of counterinsurgency specialists within the Army do believe that there is a method, a way of thinking, a way of integrating war and politics that does apply across borders, and he's going to come to Pakistan and Afghanistan with real conviction and energy about that.
Although General Petraeus has been much referred to during the presidential campaign, Petraeus obviously is staying out of the campaign. It's really not the role of the military to make endorsements. But what do you know about David Petraeus' politics and his political background?
Well, he's a registered Republican in the state of New Hampshire. He has described himself as a Northeastern Rockefeller Republican, but he, however, told me that he stopped voting in 2002. What interested me about him at this time, most of all, what drew me to this story was the dilemma of civil-military relations that his command represents. There have been other episodes in American history where generals and politicians have had to manage a divisive war and do it in a constitutional system that presumes the primacy of civilian politicians but also respects the role of professional generals. But we haven't had a whole lot of those. Vietnam is one example. MacArthur is another. And here comes a general who is very self-conscious. He's a doctoral degree holder in international relations. As one of his colleagues, West Point classmate, put it, you know, he may not want to admit it, but he's basically a political scientist. So here you have a political scientist and a general managing the most divisive war in a generation. So how do you do that? What does the law say? What, as a practical matter, can you accomplish? And so that is, I think, really the theme. As much as the war fighting in Iraq, the broader theme of his command lies in this area of civil-military relations. And it's not finished yet because here we are in the middle of a national election, and his command is probably the most important foreign policy issue, though perhaps no longer the most important issue in the election.
Okay, so reading between the lines here, when he says that he had been a Rockefeller Republican, how do you interpret that?
Well, I think he's saying that he's associating himself by implication. This was a private comment. This is not a public self-characterization, so I don't really know what he was intending to convey in the private conversation, but it sort of places him in the world of Republican realists occupied by the present president's father, George H.W. Bush, and his national security advisor, Brent Scowcroft, and that sort of era of the Republican Party that did not seek to transform the world but which sought to manage American security on the basis of sort of realism and interests.
So you think it's a way of saying that he was a Rockefeller Republican
as
opposed to a Bush Republican, a George,
not a neoconservative.
Or W. Bush Republican.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That would be the implication of it.
Steve Coll, thank you so much. Always a pleasure to talk with you.
Likewise, Jerry. Thanks for having me.
Steve Coll's article about General Petraeus, the presidential candidates, and the road out of Iraq is in the current edition of The New Yorker, where he also writes a blog. His latest book is The Bin Ladens, An Arabian Family in the American Century. The FX drama series The Shield, which in 2002 introduced Michael Chiklis as rogue cop Vic Mackey, begins its seventh and final season tonight. TV critic David Bianculli has seen the first eight of these last 13 episodes. Here's his review and his look at the impact of The Shield on today's TV landscape.
6 years ago, The Shield burst onto the TV scene with a vengeance. The vengeance was in the form of Vic Mackey, a detective running an effective but opportunistic strike force. Vic was violent, corrupt, and played by his own rules. So much so that in the pilot episode, Vic's own police captain assigned an undercover officer to investigate Vic and his unit. Vic responded quickly by shooting his fellow officer in cold blood during a routine bust and getting away with it. That's how The Shield began, shockingly. Thanks to The Sopranos on HBO, we'd gotten used to central characters who were less than heroic. But a cop who kills one of his own and isn't caught or punished? The Shield, from the very start, was something different. What has made the show outstanding, though, is that it never let go of that initial cold-blooded murder, or others that have followed since. Michael Chiklis, as Vic Mackey, won a Best Actor Emmy that first season and deserved it. Since then, his Vic has been targeted and investigated several times, but always has escaped justice. This season, though, Vic's luck finally may be running out. He's about to face a review board and most likely lose his job, but he has one last card to play, involving a box full of incriminating evidence against city officials and employees. The box has come into the possession of two people. Vic is one of them. The other, played by Benito Martinez, is the former police captain who launched the investigation against Vic in that series pilot. 6 years later, he's now a well-connected city councilman, and he and Vic are about to agree to a very uneasy alliance.
What are you doing?
There are over 100 blackmail files in this box. I only need one of them to get my badge back.
So you're going to blackmail someone just like Pasuela?
No. I'm going to give them their sin back, grant them absolution. Him giving me my badge back is just going to be his way of showing gratitude.
Right now, this intel is the only proof that we have that Pasuela's dirty. Using it as leverage will compromise it as evidence. Plus, Pasuela will know that you have the box. We can't risk exposing that now.
But now that your Kodak moment is out of this box, the hell with everyone else, right? You and me, we're never going to be friends. We both know that we're just here for survival. Now, you want to be mayor? All I want to do is keep being a cop.
But Vic has other problems in this final season, big ones, involving his family at home and his family at work. One of his own strike force members, Shane, killed another member 2 seasons ago, the same sort of cold-blooded murder Vic committed in the pilot. This year, Vic and Shane are circling each other very warily, and all of Vic's demons and evil deeds seem to be coming home to roost. Maybe Vic won't get away with murder after all, or maybe, before The Shield is over, he'll commit a few more. Either way, all I can say is I've seen all 8 preview episodes sent by FX, and I couldn't burn through them quickly enough. This is one great TV show, and series creator Sean Ryan is ending it by bringing everything to a boil, and it appears, to an actual finite conclusion. The critical and audience raves for The Shield in its first year did more than put The Shield on everyone's radar. It put the previously ignored FX network there, too. FX responded perfectly with one ambitious, edgy show after another. Rescue Me and Nip Tuck, Over There and The Riches, Damages, and, starting Wednesday, Sons of Anarchy, a new drama series about an outlaw motorcycle gang. The Shield is the forerunner of them all, and more. Rival programmers were quick to learn the FX lesson that a single show, if bold and different enough, could redefine a network. So we have Dexter on Showtime and Mad Men on AMC and other obvious examples, all due in no small part to Vic Mackey and The Shield. So watch this season as a new chapter in cop show history is being made. The TV cop genre began a half century ago with Dragnet, where Jack Webb reenacted actual police cases. Then we had a few decades of cops as flawless heroes, followed by Hill Street Blues, which introduced cops as flawed heroes and changed the genre again. Homicide: Life on the Street took an even darker look and told a bleak overall story. The idealistic rookie cop in the first season ended up being a cold-blooded killer in the finale. And in The Shield, the central cop character began as a cold-blooded killer and has gone downhill from there. It doesn't look, from the episodes I've seen, that Vic Mackey will have a soft landing. But as dramatic TV roller coasters go, it's a ride no one should miss.
David Biancooley writes about television for TVWorthWatching.com and Broadcasting and Cable Magazine. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org.